Access number 29537, Mr. Albert Arnst, Rio 7. Now, we're just talking about this first voyage. Now, you've got as far as Arendal.
Arendal,
which
yes.
is in Norway. And you seem to have stayed there a bit. We not stayed, doing much, on standby.
No, we didn't. It was kind of standby. It was a time of perhaps overhauling little things which needed overhauling. It was a time of cleaning the boats. It was a time of, you know, doing whatever was necessary. Because you had to get your own things cleaned as well. That was usually taken away and washed wherever that was, I don't know. And then we got it back.
And then where?
No, we didn't do very much. I remember the weather was quite warm. It was nice and sunny. And when we had, sort of in our spare time, we used to do a lot of sunbathing.
Did you see much of the Norwegians? How did you get on with them?
At that time, we didn't see anything at all.
Now, you then seemed to make your way up to Bergen.
Yes, we went also around the Norwegian coast into Bergen, yes. Bergen is it's quite a sort of a large port, seaport. And they had, of course, then by that time, they had already these bunkers, U-boat bunkers.
Now, what's it? Can you describe them? Because I mean, what were they like?
Well, they were the huge, thick concrete structures.
We'd call them pens, but the bunkers is just as
pens.
Good.
Well, the U-boat pens. I mean, they were very. I remember very the walls dividing the pens. I cannot remember now how many pens there were. There were more than one. Perhaps half a dozen, I would say, or something like this. And there were, we met all different submarines, some bigger ones than ours, you know, the Type 9, in different stages of overhaul, repair, provisioning, whatever.
And you were in these pens.
And you just went into the pen directed. You made fast. And what actually took place there, you were replenished regarding food or whatever you used was replenished. Of course, fuel, oil, lubricating oil, things like that.
Now, when you first got there, you seem to have gone into dry dock again for a short period. I don't know whether you remember that.
Well, yes.
You don't remember what it was from then. And it says you went into a U-boat camp. Just
yes.
Above the town.
Above Bergen. I mean, we did not sort of sleep then, actually, on the boat. We were there during the day.
Now, what was your accommodation like?
That was very nice. About sort of wooden huts, but very nicely laid out. There was a swimming pool. There was a canteen. There was recreation rooms. There were rooms for sport. Such, for instance, table tennis. We did play table tennis. There was a bar as well. You could have a drink. You bought your cigarettes. You could buy any other articles, you know, toiletries and things. And we actually were allowed to go into the town.
Now, what was a visit to town, and how did the Norwegians react? So you had been at war.
Well,
with them.
I have no recollection of any sort of aggro. The Norwegians are, I would say, very proud people. They're very clean. They seem to be very honest. And we sort of, the times we were there, we went into the town to look at the town. To see what there was, to look at the harbour, all the fishing boats. They had now what would you call these things? You know, if you think of places like Hastings or whatever, they got these funicular things going up the mountains. Something similar. It was called the Flern, and you could go in there, and you went right up that big mountains with a lovely view over the town and so. So that's what we did. We went into restaurants. We
did you drink much?
I never liked it. I can't remember the reason why. I still don't like it. I don't mind a glass of beer or a little tipple once in a while, but I've never taken to it. I don't know why. Yes,
you went in town for a nice quiet time, really. I mean, just relax.
Well, it was fairly quiet. You know, we went for a meal. I remembered we were surprised what the Norwegians were able to do with fish. All these different kind of fish. You even saw things which looked like little beautiful cakes and things. They were made out of fish. And, you know, very tasty, you know. But we went to sample these and got used to it. We went to have our hair cut. We went to the barbers. We had our shave. I remember the first time we went in there. It was so posh in there. It was so lovely. And we had a haircut. We had a shave. And after you had your shave, they put these hot towels on your face. I've never experienced that before. And that was really wonderful. That was all really I remember.
Now, from there, you set off again, don't you? Heading
from
up.
There, we set off. We went to a few smaller places along the coast before we actually got into Narvik. Drontheim.
Yeah, but you're just passing through them.
Yeah, we were so passing. Probably stayed there a day or maybe two for whatever reasons.
Now, was Narvik your final destination then?
Narvik was actually the final destination, yes.
And is this where you join your U-boat flotilla?
Yes. I can't remember which one it was. It changed a lot. You know, these flotillas changed a lot. From Narvik was one of our first really patrols, you know, actions. We operated up in above the Arctic Circle. Above Narvik is the Arctic Circle. We went up there to operate on certain convoys. We operated round the Bear Islands. We operated round the Kola Inlet, where the convoys came from Iceland into Murmansk. We had some skirmishes there.
Can you take me through? I don't know. Do you remember one operation like that, or a typical one? Because what would it be like from start to finish? You'd set up from Narvik, would you?
We set up from Narvik. And we had to, as soon as possible, when you were out of these fjords, you know, in probably enough depth of water, we had to dive. Because to operate on the surface was very, very dangerous, especially during the daytime. You know, the Allies had this half-duff, these radio direction finders. They soon got you, especially if you had to send out a message or something. It was a lot of routine. I suppose the orders were to go into a certain place, into a certain area. And as we were mostly underwater.
So if we look, say you're going to the Kola in there, because you went to the Kola quite a lot, didn't you?
Yes. Yes.
So say you were going there.
Well, I remember one we operated unsuccessfully on a convoy called JW61, I think. You know, where our leaders, Dönitz, if you like, the Grand Admiral, got a pack of submarines together to operate on a certain convoy.
Well, let's look at that operation. So you dived when you left port, and then what happens? You're just a lot of sailing underwater, is it?
Well, it was mostly underwater. At night time, we had to go on top to recharge the batteries.
Now, what would happen when you recharge the batteries at night?
Well, at one diesel was driving the boat forward, and the other diesel was charging the batteries.
So you were on the surface, but ready to crash drive?
Always ready. Yes, and well, the usual watch, one officer of the watch plus the four outlooks, and one of the junior radio operators had to be on the bridge because you had that first device. I think it was called the Biscay, the cross of Biscay. It was more or less a wooden structure like a cross with some wire strung, right? And you had to turn this by hand. You had earphones on and you listened to the sound.
Is this radar?
That was radar. Yes.
So
that was all very, very primitive.
So you would be using that and just turning it by hand?
Yes, for 4 hours on the bridge. You got cold, you got wet, you got soaked, and the Arctic is cold and very rough.
So you just
on my watch, nothing ever happened. I did not hear a sound.
Did you have trouble staying awake, or was it?
Oh, yes, you have to stay awake, yeah, of course.
No, but did you have trouble?
No. Not really, because it was so cold.
Tell me about the cold. How bad was it? Because, I mean, the British go on and on about the... quite rightly, too. I'm not... But they go on and on about how cold the Arctic Con was. You're in a lot nearer to the water than they are, if you see what I mean. How bad was it?
It was really cold. It's the dampness. There was a lot of mist and fog as well, which seemed to creep, you know, through your clothing. I mean, you wore...
What did you wear?
Oh, my goodness.
So when you went, you know, you're sent up as a junior wireless operator on to use that radar. What would you wear?
Well, you had yourself the usual working outfit on, which was more or less like a thin battle dress kind of. But you wore underneath a set of long, woolly underpants, blue, very thick. And you had the same, like a vest. You wore a pullover. You wore over that. Most of us, we organized ourselves these sheep fur vests. Over that, you wore your leather, the grey leather outfit. And over that, you wore your, what you call the Mickey Mouse, the waterproof outfit. You wore sea boots. And in your sea boots, we had perhaps as big as a hand or so. They were in, you could inserts, and when they became damp, they got warm. So you had reasonably warm feet.
And your hands?
Gloves.
Yeah. Just one pair?
One pair. Thick gloves, but they got wet.
And were you still cold?
Yeah. And I used to, you know, the first hour, you know, not so bad. But of course, you see, the sea came over when it was rough. And you had that big belt round you. You got buckled in, like the fireman got, and you hooked yourself on the bridge, because if a real breaker came over it, you would have been taken away. You couldn't hold yourself. I remember the very first time. It was still dusk, and I saw that thing, in front of me from the bow. In the sky, it was dark, and I didn't know what it was. And I thought it was a cloud. And at the same time, the officer of the watch, he shouts out, "Down!" or something. And there's a blooming wave. That wave was so big. It was like a cloud coming over you. And when it hits you, you are right underwater for a few seconds. And then it sort of gradually washes along and leaves you. And of course, you could feel it. Then it was running down your chest inside. It was running down your back. It was running down your leg, in your boots. It was not very nice. Definitely not very nice. But you had 4 hours. So we used to do it, say, starting midday from 12 to 4 was one watch. The other
now,
one...
So that you'd be underwater then, wouldn't you?
Wherever you were, on top or
tell
down.
Me about the watch system. So continue.
Say starting at midday, you had from midday to 1600 hours. Then you had from 1600 to 2000 hours. But during the night, for some reason I don't know, during the night was what we called the English watch. How this came about, I do not know. From 2000 hours, you had this 6 hours till 02 in the morning. from 02 in the morning you had till 08 in the morning, and then it went back from 8 to 12, from 12 to 4. And six hours, I can tell you, that is a heck of a long time.
Now, if you weren't, I mean, when you were under the sea, what would a watch be? You'd be on wireless duty, would you? What would you
When you were under the sea, you were on your listening device. There was a certain time during the night, I think it was round about 2 o'clock, on certain days of the week. We had one of us junior wireless operators, we had to be one on the listening device and one in the wireless room, and we had to listen to what we called the midnight press. I think it was something roughly about an hour. You got all the news coming in, and that was given on that extra long wave, because it goes to certain depths, you know, in the water, through the water. Short wave and long wave didn't do that.
And this was news.
So we had to actually, yeah, it was a kind of a news. What happened in the world, or what happened at home, or what happened wherever. And you had a book like this, a ledger, and you had to write it down, right? And you had to sign it, and that was then handed to the captain for the officers to read. But that was for about 1 hour, roughly about 2 in the morning, maybe 3 or perhaps 4 times a week. It wasn't every night. That was okay, but it was a bit boring. It depending depending on who the sender was. You know, some wars were nice and some were a bit garbled, and you know, each operator has his own way of giving signals. And after a while you could already recognize, oh, that's the same one again. Oh, you know.
Now, what are the, you know, you're on duty, what else are you listening? So you're listening to the acoustic device,
yes,
right? Or you're in the other room, one room or the other?
Well, the acoustic was, underwater was always occupied.
So someone would be on that?
Always occupied, yes. And underwater, obviously, you run on your electric motors. And to preserve energy, you go at a certain speed at so and so many revolutions per minute. And there was one revolution, I think it was 90, was it 90 revolutions per minute, which was called a creeping speed. It was worked out that at that revolution, we had two propellers, made the least noise. Because the more noise you have somewhere else, it interferes with your listening. I mean, when the diesels were running, you couldn't hear a thing.
Now, what would you hear? I mean, what did you hear on listening duty?
Oh, you hear when you are up in the oceans, but in the Arctic. Well, you hear a lot of noises, such as whales, for instance. You know, whales squeak, you know, like that. But you knew what that was. And when you heard, which I have heard at times, you hear a ship's noise, a propeller noise, which was mostly. Now, so slow, you knew that was sort of steam engine, freighters, whatever. So once you heard that, you had to pinpoint it where it was, remember where it was, then you had to sweep round again 360 degrees to come back to the same noise, and then you have to distinguish whether it has moved forward, whether it's louder, whether it's moving away. If it's reasonably and moving louder, you had to contact the officer on watch, usually the captain, which was sleeping. When he was not on watch, he was sleeping opposite me. I had to just call out, you know, captain noise, and explain to him what it was. And according to his judgment, he said, well, keep listening and tell me what happened, where it goes, if it's louder or quieter and so. We had once or twice when it did get louder, when he decided then to service, to have a look round through his periscope. But that was mostly either too far away. Of course, you see, you are very near the surface of the sea, aren't you? And you haven't got a long distance to see. So he just kept on looking at times, and then he had to make his decision what to do, what course to steer. Shall we go towards it, or shall we ignore it, or according to the instructions which he had to operate in a certain area. You know, the map, the German map was made into squares all over the seas, and each square had a number. And you were ordered to operate in that square in order to know that you actually were in that square. You had to either on dead reckoning, or if possible, if it was possible, the navigation officers plus one or two other officers went on top to either shoot the stars to get an accurate position. And that involved us, the wireless operator on duty, because in the room where the listening device was, we had that chronometer that was in sort of a drawer, green felt. It was hanging cardanic. You know what that means? It was in a ring, so it was always horizontal. And that was very accurate, a very accurate chronometer. When on top, when they had their star, their whatever constellation inside, and had the stopwatch ready, they called down, and then I had to tell them the exact time. And then they put their stopwatch down, and then they worked out exactly where they were. That was then all handed down into the control room, where somebody with all the instruments worked out exactly where we were. And that was probably as near as you could be. Quite often, we were miles out because of the underwater currents. You can't see them, you can't hear them, you can't fix them. That's why it was necessary.
Now, did you operate in packs, or were you just covering an area?
In packs. We were mostly in impacts.
So where were they? I mean, would you see them?
No.
So there'd be a pack of you in a square?
Yeah.
But you wouldn't see each other?
No. I mean, whether sometimes the people on the bridge saw something, I don't know.
So you operated as individual ships within a pack?
Within a
pack, if you saw a convoy, you'd make your own attacks, you wouldn't coordinate them.
That's right. Now, well, whatever signals came in, they had to be decoded.
Now tell me about that side. So if you weren't on the acoustic listening, you'd be on the wireless. Mm. Now what were your duty? What was a typical duty roster? You told me about taking down the news, but what else would you be doing?
Well, that was actually it. It was to be to take the news down, the midnight press or whatever it was called, and it was to man the listening device. That was the main duty of us three young. Sometimes we took messages.
Who from?
Wherever they came, from headquarters, from Berlin, from wherever, I don't know.
And you'd pick them up mainly on the surface?
Mainly on the surface, yes.
And what kind of message would come in? Would you decode it? I mean, would you know what it was?
No, you write the messages down, and you hand it to the officer in charge.
So they
decode it, because they got the keys to the decoding. What set the rotors had to be, what set all the connectors have to be. No, we didn't.
So you didn't use the Enigma, at that?
No. We knew how to use it.
You'd been trained, but you weren't the ones who did it.
No.
Now, what would happen if you did sight a convoy? Did you remember? I mean, you sighted this convoy we're looking at, JW61, I think you said. JW61. Now, what happened on that? Say on that attack. What happened? What went wrong?
Well, all I know that the so-called attack was unsuccessful. Either we were in the wrong place, or we were not near enough, or I would say now in hindsight, knowing all the things which have happened, which we didn't know then, the convoy was either diverted, they altered course. Of course, you know that Bletchley Park could read the signals probably sometimes faster than we got them. So they diverted the convoys. They knew where we were. And
this is all the old
nothing. Stuff. Nothing very much happened.
Now, did you make any attacks in the early days on ships?
We at the Kola Inlet in some months we operated there.
And what do you remember of that?
There was a convoy coming in, whichever one it was. And, you know, we had, at that time, we had these acoustic torpedoes, which were not very, very reliable, as I learned later on. But these acoustic torpedoes homing in on the noise of the propellers from ships. And in order to counteract that, the escorts towed devices behind them. We called them the singing saws, you know, like you have one of these long circular saws when you cut wood, it screams, doesn't it? And it makes a real noise to divert torpedoes whenever they were shot. And that is a heck of a noise. You heard it all over the place. You could hear the ships, you could hear these noises, and you could hear also the depth charges when a boat was attacked. On one occasion at the Kola Inlet, we torpedoed a Russian destroyer. I was not on duty at that time. I knew it was happening. I knew the torpedo was shot.
What was the procedure on fire? You know, when you made an approach run, what was the procedure on board the ship, typically?
It was obvious, mostly, I would say, underwater. The captain himself, he was sitting up in the conning tower on the periscope. He had a seat, and it was electrically worked, so it rotated. And all the measurements, the distances, the speed, and all that was calculated in one of these machines, whatever you call them. And that was transferred into the torpedo room, onto the torpedoes, and when the captain thought things were right, distance, speed, and whatever, and all the figures added up, it was already a kind of computer thing. Then he gave the order fire, and the torpedo was shot.
And would it always be acoustic, or just sometimes?
We had ordinary ones where the propulsion was by compressed air, which of course gives you away because the bubble, stream of bubbles. We had the electric ones, which did not make any bubbles. And then there were the acoustic torpedoes, and later on they had these very advanced things, torpedoes. I can't remember what they were called. So you would shoot four torpedoes at the convoy, and they were programmed in such a way that when they came at a certain distance, they changed courses and went zigzag all over the place, hoping to hit a ship within that area. They were planned that. How well they worked, I don't know. We hit that destroyer. There was that enormous bang.
Do you know its name?
Yes. You speak Russian?
Have a go. I can just put Russian to it. What happened? What do you remember happening? You weren't watching then? You weren't on duty, were you? Or were you?
No. I was off duty, but I knew what was taking place. You know, I could hear all the orders and all the preparations. And there was torpedo went out. And after a while, it wasn't a very long time. It must have been quite nearish. There was that mighty explosion. which of course meant it was a hit. And then we heard noises in the water, sort of crunching and, you know, things breaking. And then, of course, we heard when the escort, the other escorts came. Then we got the Aztec, the ping, ping,
ping. I'll come back to that because it's going to have to stop. What was the name of the destroyer? Can you just say it in Russian? No, you don't know. Okay, offhand. We'll look it up later.